welcome to Do the Right Thing, your weekly writing prompt podcast. I'm Alexandra.
And I'm Jarvis.
Jarvis and I are two blues musicians trying to make it in the old music city, but we can't make it into any of the classy bars because we are just street musicians and we don't know any sheet music.
Mm-hmm. So to up our sheet music proficiency and start, you know, really spitting some fine bars, we are issuing a challenge. Each week you sit down to write a complete short story using three or four words from that week.
Then we sit down on the podcast, we read a story, we talk about what we learned in writing it, or in reading it. Now, man, I'm really bungling this one up. It's been a rough week, y'all.
It's been a very rough week.
And then we talk about stories sent in by you wonderful listeners.
Mm-hmm. We're simply here to help you do the right thing.
So, Doof Media Production. So last week was finals week. That's number one. I just did a 2-day road trip to bring furniture and stuff to my dad's new apartment. Or it was more like 3 days. Drove cross country, and then I've just gotten back literally earlier today. So I am frazzled and dazzled, and so mm-hmm. that's why this episode's coming out a day late.
We can't forget my sickness.
Yeah, that's right. That's the other thing, is that Jarvis is not feeling real well. What happened? Mm-hmm. Tell us about it.
It started with a headache, and I was like, I am man. Man don't get headache. But then I got very, very tired, and I had the works, runny nose, the cough, and I was worried. I didn't know, hey, am I actually dying? Like, is this it?
Mm-hmm.
It was mostly in my throat, really. But waking up today, I got better, at least when it came to the throat. So I went, got COVID tested, did that whole thing, and then they hit me with $120 Jesus. Bill, which hurt more than being sick.
Yeah.
So for the good portion of today, hence why I am tired, also with the sickness, was spent trying everything I can to weasel out of paying these people $120 for me to sit in their waiting room for 3 hours.
Yeah.
So today's been pretty good, not gonna lie.
You should try faking your own death. That works for me pretty often.
Honestly, I might have to, because I don't like having to owe people, because I know like a lot of people within my family can't get houses because of that.
Because they fake their own death.
Be one of them. No, because they owe people, like they owe rent or they owe a hospital or something like that. So if y'all don't hear from me in the next six months. In the next 6 months, just look up someone named Hogan Hauser.
That's a good idea.
And you'll find
my strategy is always to get a different payday loan from a different loan shark. So if you only hit each one of them up once, they only send like one guy after you. You know, when they meet up with each other, they kind of like, you know, they fight each other for the turf, sort of. So it kind of handles itself. Yeah. You will need like a new car every like 3 months though, and new tires like every two. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, hey, with that like payday loan, you don't really have to worry about it. You just have to get it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Because you already have
the
money.
Here's one thing you can do. You can go to one payday loan shark, right? And then you pay the last one with that payday loan. And then with that one, you take out a new loan and then you pay the last one before that. And you just kind of do a whole
cycle it through.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of strategies out here in middle America. A lot of things you can do out here. This is now a financial podcast. Do you know how many financial podcasts there are? It's kind of like obscene.
Probably a lot more than I think. I would say at least 5,000 of them.
I really hope that they all have like two listeners each, because like it's just kind of gross, honestly.
Listening to people talk about stocks and bonds.
There's just
for 2 hours.
Corporate podcasts are just like the most disgusting thing to me. But that is neither here nor there nor in between. Mm-hmm. Jarvis, what are the words this week?
Thank you for asking. The words for this week are proclaim, impact, archive, and resist. And y'all listeners wrote wonderful stories this week, ample amount of them, about death.
Yeah, thank you very much for bringing my spirits down. You all did a fantastic job. And that's the final stories before the deadline for the Do the Right Thing contest. So yes. Absolutely fantastic job to everyone that did that. I really wish that we had been able to get this podcast out the day of the deadline rather than the day after. But everyone that sent in their stories for the contest, fantastic job. To be honest, like if you know you squeaked over the deadline or something like that, and you know you just needed a tiny bit of extra time sending in your stories, that's okay. You know, go ahead and send it in anyway. But the deadline is passed. Those stories are in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really excited to read them all.
Yeah, I can't wait to read all of them and see what wonderful works y'all came up with. Also for this podcast, we will be reading a little bit of poetry
this week. Yeah.
To talk about rhythm and rhyme, and just mostly talking about the flow and, how when you take a lot of, when you pay a lot of attention to your prose will pay off for themselves.
Mm-hmm. So what is the thing that we're reading this week?
We will be reading The Weary Blues by Langston Hughes, one of my favorite poets and one of my favorite poems.
Do you know any stuff about Langston Hughes? Can you tell us about him?
Oh, well, yeah. He was a very prominent figure during the Harlem Renaissance.
A
lot of his work speaks for itself. I mean, most of his work is either talking about the black experience, which is very common. Well, I mean, that's the whole point of the Harlem Renaissance. But he has a very nice twist to it, to where in a lot of his works, it almost feels like the eye is foreign to this sort of new black mm-hmm. culture. To where during the time, his work was a lot more accessible to a wider audience than most, because of his willingness to, I guess, let the reader understand it first, kind of dumb it down, uh-huh. In a sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, really great artist, really great stuff that he came up with.
Yeah, the stuff about accessibility, that's an interesting point. It's a question I asked one of my professors at one point, right? Because we were doing a lot of analysis of like Wordsworth and these fancy poets and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was like so complex and required so much like historical like understanding and like reading, you know, classics and epics and stuff like that. And, yeah. You know, a lot of research. And I was like, was poetry, especially like poetry that we see nowadays, where it was very, I mean, obviously it's a gigantic breadth of poetry, but the ones that we study in class, right, are the complicated ones. So I was asking, mm-hmm. like, has poetry always been like this sort of puzzle thing, right, that you have to figure out and like do all this research? Like when people were originally writing it, you know, back in the 1800s, these poems that we're analyzing, did they understand it better than we do now, like more naturally, or did they have to do as much like in-depth reading? The truth is that no, it was actually a lot easier for them to understand it. Like,
oh really?
Okay. Like most of the audiences that those poets were writing for had read the classics, had read the Bible and things like that, and so it was easy for them to make the connections. It's like, you know, if you make a reference to a TV show or something now, right? Like a good amount of people would get it,
but yeah. Someone 1,000 years from now won't get it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and they'll need a degree to understand what the hell we were talking about when we make our memes. So,
Yeah. Honestly, in some weird way, poetry is just a form of a meme.
Yeah. Yep. Pretty much. One of the ones that we analyzed in my introduction to analysis class was mm-hmm. It was basically this like mass produced like song, right? Like basically they would put out some of these publishers would put out like really shitty poems just to basically make them go viral, make everyone like want a copy of like a shitty song with like the lyrics. And it's just like this one was a song about it was about a whore stealing from a rich man, but it was told through like a metaphor of like two ships intertangling, right? But like but like it's also like a sex metaphor. Like he like boards her, you know what I mean? So and it's like to another tune, it's actually like full of shit rhymes that like don't actually really work. And so you like if you were actually singing it, you'd have to like speak fast at some points and stuff like that to like catch it up to the rhythm. And those were mass produced. Anyway, that's like a tie into like, I don't know, all the covers you see on YouTube and stuff like that that blow up and then die real fast. And then it was intended to be used as toilet paper. That's actually where you find a lot of poems in historical digs. You find them in ancient toilets.
Really? Because they would, so I guess people would just write them, or like they would use them as toilet paper.
Yeah, so they were mass printed on super cheap paper, and you only have so much paper, and so you go to the bathroom, and then after you're done reading it and trying to memorize lyrics so you can impress your friends at the pub, you wipe your ass with it and you leave it in the toilet. And then eventually when all that stuff gets covered with dirt and stuff like that, archaeologists dig through your shit later on in the future and they find this poem. That's where they found it. I'm not even kidding.
Wow, they found it in the giant the shitter. Turd.
Yeah, in a literal shithole.
So that makes me feel good, because no matter how bad my work will ever be, I guarantee no one will wipe their ass with it.
I mean,
actually, I don't know about that.
I'm going to start printing all of my work on toilet paper.
Mm-hmm. And then you should print them out and then put them in like a fucking Angel Soft package.
Okay.
And then put that on the shelf in Walmart.
I feel like that would be a good like one of those like viral campaigns where it just kind of relies on someone random finding it and doing all the advertising for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, hey, eventually you'll be rich.
That's right.
Or you'll be really good at making toilet paper.
Yeah, and at the very end of the toilet paper, I'll have a link to Do the Right Thing. All right, let's get into reading the poem. Go ahead, Jarvis.
Sure thing. All right. The Weary Blues by Langston Hughes. Droning a drowsy syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon, I heard a Negro play. Down on Lenox Avenue the other night, by the pale, dull parlor of an old gas light, he did a lazy sway. He did a lazy sway to the tune, Oh, Those Weary Blues. With his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody, Oh, blues. Swaying to and fro on his rickety stool, he played that sad raggedy tune like a musical fool. Sweet blues, coming from a black man's soul, oh blues. In a deep song voice with a melancholy tone, I heard that Negro sing, that old piano moan. Ain't got nobody all in this world. Ain't got nobody but myself. I's gonna quit my frownin' and put my troubles on the shelf. Thump, thump, thump went his foot on the floor. He played a few chords and he sang some more. I got the weary blues and I can't be satisfied. Got the weary blues and I can't be satisfied. I ain't happy no mo', and I wish that I had died. Far off into the night, he crooned that tune. The stars went out, and so did the moon. The singer stopped playing and went to bed, while the weary blues echoed through his head. He slept like a rock, or a man that's dead. There's this really nice version of Langston Hughes saying this poem on a live TV.
Ooh.
That perfectly captures it, and it's beautiful because it has a jazzy backdrop. There's a band right behind him. It's actually a really good video.
You should put in a link.
Sure, I'll do that later.
Great. Yeah, you can go ahead and keep that information so people can hear it. Yeah, how was your reading? Because I didn't get to hear it yet.
Oh, yeah, my reading was pretty good. I pretty much mimicked Langston Hughes.
Wow.
From his reading, or at least tried. And yeah, I mean, through and through, it was a pretty decent reading. I tried to really feel it, you know, especially when I said, "Oh, blues." I was thinking, "Damn, how would my black man soul say this?"
So, Jarvis, why did you choose this one in particular to bring?
Well, I chose it because I think that this poem really portrays place along with flow. I mean, especially when watching this video of Langston Hughes reading it out loud to a jazz background, you really do get how the way that this poem is written and the way that it is supposed to be read matches up to a lot of typical jazz beats, mm-hmm. typical jazz sway. And I think that this poem does a fantastic job of bringing that musicality over into the written language, to where just by reading this, you get this beautiful picture of this man putting his heart and his soul into this song that he is singing. Also, there is a lot of great commentary there on like what the point and purpose of blues really is,
mm-hmm.
how this man has had such a hard road that his way of working through his issues is by playing this very sad, very slow and somber music and putting his whole soul into it, to where when he does go to sleep later on that night, there's nothing really left in him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that final line is really I love that one. The
mm-hmm.
While the weary blues echo through his the singer stopped playing and went to bed, while the weary blues echo through his head, he slept like a rock or a man that's dead. And mm-hmm. I like
beautiful.
Yeah. One thing I really love about this poem, for an example about flow and stuff like that, is that there's a lot of variety here, right? It's not.
Mm-hmm.
A thing with jazz, right, is that it doesn't necessarily follow like a specific melody, right? It has a mm-hmm. lot more variety. It flows. It goes up and down and changes over the course of a song. Mm-hmm. Speeds up and slows down, and that's kind of what happens here, right? You have these lines, and they're broken up by stuff like "Oh, blues," or switching up
"Sweet blues,"
mm-hmm, or
"He did a lazy swear."
Yeah, repetition and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, something that I really like with that repetition, and something that I didn't even realize until I heard him say it, is that both of those lines, he did a lazy sway, they are read two completely different ways.
Mm-hmm.
The first one typically is supposed to be quote-unquote read a lot slower, but the second one mm-hmm. flows perfectly into the line that's right below it, to where it seems like one word, right? And I think of course that just further shows exactly how the flow and musicality of jazz is being shown in this poem.
Mm-hmm.
How you know, as you said, there are those highs, there are those lows, and there are those long runs that is completely different from the rest of the piece, but you're with it. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. I think one thing that definitely, for anything that you want sung, obviously rhyme is really important. So I think it would be probably helpful to run through it right now and sort of look at how rhyme is being used here. Let's just go through it real quick, right? So tune and croon, so that's AA. Play, B, and then night and light, so CC. And then you have BB again with sway and sway. And then blues comes up, and it's rhymed with blues in a bit. You have blues, key, melody. And then I guess blues. Key and melody might be rhyming.
They are. They're supposed to be. Key, melody.
It's a slant rhyme, but yeah. Blues, stool, and then fool. Blues again, soul. Blues, tone, moan.
Moan.
So
you, and then it's world. Oh, no. Never mind.
Well, what I think is I'm kind of noticing is that he's allowing some lines that don't rhyme in here, or at least spacing out some of those rhymes. There's the what's it called? Not double rhyme, pairs? No, couplets. That's what it is. There's couplets, but there's other rhymes spacing that apart too. There's a when he gets to the part where the guy is singing the song, he switches up the when he's quoting the singer, right? He switches up the rhyme scheme. Instead of being couplets, it's what's it called when it's four? Oh my gosh, I need to remember that stuff. Doubles. But it's world, self, frownin', shelf. I think one of the key things in this one, anyway, where we're looking at jazz, is that there's a lot of variety here.
Definitely. Yeah. So, I mean, when it comes to the challenge for next week, I think the biggest thing that y'all should really take away from this story is the focus on these pros, how they take on a own sound within their selves. And that is something that you can very well do in your own writing. And it doesn't have to be a poem. Just making sure to pay close attention to the words that you are using and trying to not only create a good story, but also establish a culture of how to read that story is, I guess, a bigger challenge for y'all to attempt next week.
Yeah, one of these weeks we got to look at Shakespeare and looking at meter that way. I think Shakespeare is probably a good place to learn meter because it's all in, you know, a set. It's iambic pentameter, right? It's pretty easy to catch on to, while stuff like this has more variety.
Postmodern.
it's easier to it's harder here to fit the pattern because you kind of have to figure it out with each sentence rather than just knowing what it is and then matching it to the syllables. So I think one of the main things here is probably the rhyme scheme and figuring out rhyme. It does not come supernaturally to me. I often have to use stuff like Rhyme Zone and stuff like that. But I think it's something worthy of trying. With prose, when it's not set into poetry, sometimes rhyme can feel, I don't know, sometimes tacky.
And I mean, really, I find that it's dependent on the amount of its usage. Because, you know, if it's all rhyme, then, of course, the like, first thought is that, oh, this is some sort of fairy tale. You know, it's done, you know, cooked well. But using it slightly throughout your pieces, maybe even on more impactful moments, or better putting that rhyme within your own piece itself can keep it from feeling, you know, tacky.
Yeah, and maybe spacing it out and using a variety might make it feel easier. Sometimes you don't even really notice that things are rhyming until, you know, you're going through it, and then you realize that something that you're reading actually flows really well, and then you pick it out because some of the stuff is more spaced apart. So definitely. Just putting maybe a line or two in between some of your rhymes can help with that, I think. And also, they don't have to, you know, things can rhyme in the middle of the sentence, too. They don't necessarily have to be just at the end, especially when it's prose where there's no, you know, line breaks to do that for you. So, yeah, there's a lot of things that that you can try out.
Definitely. But all right, I think that is enough time to give to our true and most loyal fan, Langston Hughes.
From beyond the grave, subscribing.
From beyond the grave.
Podcatcher. Real quick, mm-hmm. I want to, this is not actually about rhythm and flow, although I think that should be the challenge, is to write something using some rhymes and trying to emulate some sort of poetic language and looking at a poem. And maybe trying to emulate that. So one thing I want to complain about real quick is I need a new podcatcher. So I was using Stitcher, but Stitcher doesn't allow you to add your own RSS feed, unless if you're adding it as a real podcast, like individuals can't do it. And I wanted to add the bonus content feed to my podcatcher, because you can do that. You can get those bonus content podcasts right on your phone without having to go to the Patreon. But Stitcher doesn't let you do that. So I got a new one. I got Podcast Addict. And Podcast Addict is even worse. I hate it. I hate it so much. I need a new one right now. It's terrible. So if y'all have any good podcast catcher recommendations, please send me an email. It's very important to interrupt the lesson of the week.
Of course. But, as always, let's just go ahead and move on into our listener-submitted story section. As you know, we are going to spoil all of these stories, so after we announce them, stop, pause, go, read them, and then come back so you'll know what we are talking about.
That's right.
So, the stories we are going to be reading this week are by Glittering Coast, Nicked You, Captain Rhino, Mora Didamale, and Calinero 985.
You should forgive yourself for having difficulty with Matt's name, because that's the Mora Didamale. It's specifically made to be the hardest thing to pronounce. So thanks. Yes. Thanks, Matt. We appreciate it.
It's very mouthy.
Thank you, Matthew Freeman. All right, let's get into it. Who is first?
First is Nicked You with Savior.
So this is a really great story. We start off establishing the speak of the main character, who says, "You must resist Satan's temptations. You must resist, or the final death will await you," I hollered onto the streets. So we immediately establish that our main character here is a street preacher, and as he goes, we realize
evangelist.
Yeah, he's not actually, like, this is not a twist on that character, right? Where sometimes the madman on the street is correct, or I mean, you know, we don't know if he's correct or not, but that he's you know, actually being prophetic, right? No, he's just being a prick. He's being the asshole on the street that is yelling at people not to lay together unwed. It's an abomination in the eyes of the Lord. and then going on. And so he asks the crowd, you know, who wishes to be saved, and no one answers. And he feels like a failure, right? And his wife left him, even though she used to join him, and now he's alone to preach on the streets. And so we see a couple of scenes of him preaching. He's already old when the story starts, but he gets older as he goes. His wife sent him away on her deathbed because he had, like, begged her to repent and things like that. So as we go through, we realize that he just cannot stop from this mission of his, right? He only knows to yell at people this one way, and he can't really speak about anything else. And so we kind of, upon rereading the story, we're like, maybe his wife sent him away because he just wouldn't use their time to actually be with her, and instead was trying to get her to repent rather than like actually being with him. The next scene, he is on the street and he talks to a child for a second and say, basically scarring the child with this vision of the earth being destroyed, and then is about to call the kid's parents, who are a gay couple, you know, the F slur. and he gets punched in the face for it, and is and ending that scene with the knowledge that his son no longer speaks to him, which is interesting because his son is not in that scene, and I think that's just like a this is the sort of thing that makes his kids not want to pay attention. So basically, his final thing, he's completely alone. He doesn't have any finances. he even is horrible to the person that is taking care of him in the hospital, calling her a deviant. And we finish here with I was certainly dying. It would be soon now. I wondered how many people I had actually saved. I hope my son could still be saved if by someone else. I could certainly not save him. God forgive me for my failures. So I really love how this story depicts this preacher's life and sort of it really masterfully tells us without having to tell us what's going on here, which is that this guy has pushed everyone away, and this one, you know, he has a noble cause, right? He really does think that he needs to save people from eternal damnation, but he does it in this self-righteous way that only hurts people, and he doesn't actually try to speak to them at all.
Definitely. I mean, I really dig this story first and foremost because I really like the point of view that is being used here. It reminds me a lot of this James Baldwin short story, "Going to Meet the Man," which is also told from the point of view of someone that you would normally consider the quote-unquote villain, right? The bad person, the person that is preaching hate on the streets. And, I mean, as you said, I think through this point of view, we also gain more understanding into the possible mind of this person, to where by the end, I really understood kind of who this character is and why they are where they are. So overall, I mean, it's really great storytelling through and through. And I'm hooked to it the entire time because it's this very rich point of view coupled with a lot of great moments and flashbacks about their life that leads up to their final end. So overall, fantastic job. Really dug it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it drew out this life with great clarity. So.
Mm-hmm. All right. Up next is Glittering Coast with a new adventure.
So we open here that our main character lives in the cave with others of her coven, and it's her home, and she really likes her home. They all have magic with the element of death, which she knows that the outside world probably doesn't like as much, but it's home, and she uses it well enough. Eventually, she needs to leave. The time of her Zugalal, which we assume is like a sort of coming-of-age ceremony where she has to leave for like half a year at least to find a place in the world, comes, and she has to go. So she goes to the nearest city, and she gets there, and already she's like assailed on the way out, right? She has to fight off monsters and things to get there. When she gets to the city, she's like overwhelmed by the sights and sounds, and she's supposed to go to this one boarding house that's run by someone with the same kind of magic as her, so it would be biased, you know, in her favor. But instead, she takes a risk and follows a kind stranger to go to a different place, and gives them her information and what time she can work and stuff like that, and what's her magic. And she writes death, and there's clear that there might be like some judgment, but not too much. And she gets to her room and settles in, and she's able to get a job at a bookshop, which is a really cute idea, you know, for a witch. and starts making friends and exploring the city. And it's starting to feel like home, even though she misses the coven. And she decides that maybe she might stay there a bit longer and sort of get over her fear of the big world.
Yeah, definitely. So I really do like the world building within this story. I mean, we are thrown into this coven, and as we continue to read, we really get a sense of kind of how that works and how this main character views that as home, only to go to a completely different place. And we really get a lot of great bits with this character and really get to understand exactly what kind of makes up home for them. And overall, I just really liked the journey, and I left reading it with a really great feeling that this new way of them kind of doing things, they're becoming more accustomed to, and it leaves me with a really nice warm feeling. Mm-hmm. So great job.
Glitter and Coast analyzed their own story, and they came up with their own criticism about how the story doesn't feel like it has a lot of direction, and mm-hmm. I kind of felt that as well, but only near the end. It felt like it had a lot of direction at the beginning and just didn't have a complication, and I think that's basically all this story needed. Like, what is something to add to the conflict? Some people in the comments also, you know, suggested that the boarding house she goes to might be like suspicious and things like that, and I think that's probably like a really good place to add that complication, right? There's already places to use some tropes there, right? Like, you find yourself at a boarding place, she signs something, you already set up all these notes for the trope of like getting locked into signing, you know, fulfilling a contract that is actually really exploitative, right? And then, you know, maybe she has to work these super long hours and, you know, has to escape the evil, you know, evil school teacher kind of trope. And not that she's a school teacher, but those tropes are already there. I think just adding a sort of complication, something else for the character to face, mm-hmm. was the only thing that this story needed.
Definitely. But great job. And up next is Mora did a mail with
let me just say that, because that's stuttering. No, that's
the,
fine.
The Anaristi Vigilante.
Yeah, okay. Matt says that this is a fanfic of The Dispossessed, which was, as he promised, in last month's book club. That's the book that they covered. I think. Oh gosh, I haven't been paying enough attention to the book club. I'm too behind on my reading. I started catching up on Pact, or Pale, I mean.
Nice.
Which are so good. They're so good. I keep forgetting how good these stories are. Anyway. I have no idea if there's spoilers in this. If you don't want any spoilers of The Dispossessed, I assume maybe don't listen to the next couple minutes. Yes, I don't know. I have no idea what the level it is. But anyway, Vishek is hammering on the door of Remor, talking about how there's been 5 murders. And we get more information that 5 women have been killed in the town in the past few months. So Vishek, it wants to investigate, right? He's the one that he says he's gonna solve the murder. So he goes inside. This is a place with no locks. Odonian people don't have any locks at all. It's sort of against their principles, but there's a safe to keep in the mining tools, which Vishek is asking Remor to give him one to be used as a weapon against for self-defense against whoever this murderer is. And we get a little bit of hints of world building here that I think are done pretty naturally, where Vishek is worrying about, you know, he's all for like not having locks, but also some things maybe should have locks, you know, dangerous weapons, you know, maybe a kid shouldn't get into them because he could blow stuff up, which would be bad. We have a conversation here. Remor is trying to talk him out of being a vigilante and investigating, but Vishek is dead set on it. There's been 5 deaths. It seems like there's definitely a murderer. It's clear that he's not a detective, right? He's just somewhat, he's hyped up and thinks he's going to be one. Remor tells him to practice with the gun in the ravine, so somewhere outside of the city, to make sure that he, you know, knows how to use it. And Vishek says, you know, he's going to start interrogating someone the next day, and he leaves. And then we stay with Rimmor after Vishek leaves. Rimmor thinks about how if Vishek tries to fire the plasma cutter without fixing something, it probably will kill him. Rimmor is going to need to follow him into the ravine to ensure that Vishek's test fire resulted in a catastrophic accident. Then he would need to consider requesting a transfer to another town. He had become complacent, and he silently thanked Vishek, the perfect socially conscious Odonian vigilante, for pointing it out. So, they're revealing that, the actual prime suspect was the one that's trusted the most, which is a wonderful, wonderful twist.
I know, it's a great twist. And I mean, overall, I really do dig this story. I love the back and forth between Vishek and Rimmor. I really think that they do have a pretty good rapport. And I think that really does drive me through this story, coupled with really great world building and a really good use of place. And I mean, honestly, after reading this, I will try to dive into the book, or at least listen back to the old book clubs, because I don't know, this short story makes this world seem very interesting, especially towards the end when we get that nice twist that kind of puts a really nice final punctuation on this story. So really, really great job overall.
Yeah, I think the twist about Rimmor being actually the suspect is one of those really great examples of a surprising but inevitable twist, where it's like, oh, of course, even though it's a very short story to set that up.
Definitely. So thank you very much. And up next is Captain Rhino with Sacrifices Must Be Made.
So Captain Rhino notes that they were writing about death before it was cool. I'll allow it. It's plenty of people following the theme this week, so we really appreciate that. So the general has a plank of wood stuck through his chest. He's pretty he's bummed out about that, because he's been through so many battles and things like that. But what's going to kill him, at least as he thinks, is going to be his carriage slipping off the road and crashing, and the driver is pinned under the carriage, and he has a piece of wood through his chest, and the horse is dead, and they're probably not going to be saved. And instead of, you know, dying in battle or something like that. How ignoble. Then this boy appears, gaunt and pale like a starved street urchin, yet dressed in an undertaker's somber finery complete with child-sized top hat. And immediately he recognizes this child as who it is, which is Death. And I really like this characterization of Death here. It's just, it's nice and different, and yet suits it. Mm-hmm. And so they start to have a conversation, and Death is in a little bit inhuman, but still, you know, humanized in some way. It makes mistakes, right? It misconstrues what the general's saying. And they have a conversation. The general's just, you know, he's dying from just a freak accident, no assassination or anything like that. But the Death asks the general if he regrets all of the sacrifices he's made in his life, and the general says no. Everything was important, and all the sacrifices were not in vain, and that they were for the betterment of the country and stuff like that. And he says that he'll accept whatever consequences there are for that. And Death then says, why would I take away one of my most valuable servants? If I leave you here, you'll bring me thousands of extra sacrifices. And then he leaves with people arriving just in time to probably save the general. And he has a strange feeling that he's forgotten something terribly important.
Wow. So yeah, this story is really, really good. I mean, if not for its very unique characterization of Death that is also very fitting, I think overall just a lot of the flow within this and the back and forth between Death and this soldier all feels very well placed, and it really does help to kind of round out this scene and this world overall. And I also do like the idea of death not being infallible. You know, as you said, in this story, death misconstrues what the soldier is saying, and even comes up with its own conclusions, which is a pretty nice amount of commentary on, I guess, the nature of death. But yeah, overall, I think I just really like this story, and I think it's wonderfully set in one place, and it's simple in this way to where you completely get everything that is being said. So really great job.
Yeah, I think it's very economical for sure.
All right. Our final story for this week is by Calinero 985 with The Reaper and the Dancer.
So Tyrus, he approaches a prison where there's two guards outside who have been under his employment before, and he's a little nervous. If we could tell it from the way that he's thinking about things. He has to intimidate these guards to let him inside. They say, "I don't know if that's a good idea, sir," but they fall under his intimidation. Although he, you know, interesting setup. But he gets in there and he sees his daughter. Who she is, you know, dirty and things like that, but she doesn't look, you know, like, despairing either. There's a little bit of world building here where we see her hands are inside these sort of witch's shackles that twist her hand into uncomfortable shapes, make sure that she can't use magic. So we understand, you know, that she's a witch that's been captured, right? That's what it looks like. But they start talking. And that, anything. She just said that some witchcraft stuff was hers, even though it wasn't. And as we understand, as we go, is that, she intentionally, said that they were hers, right? Made it seem like she's the one that's in trouble, because the people that would have been in trouble, you know, the actual witches, even though they're not, like, really, you know, they're not evil witches, they're just misunderstood, were these traveling people, and that they certainly would be executed if, while she, you know, might get off with a slap on the wrist, or at least a relative slap on the wrist, right? A time in jail, and maybe escaping, and being penitent, and things like that, but being okay. And, you know, she's being very noble, right? But Tyrus tells her that, no, word has traveled, the church has sent an inquisitor, so she's gonna get burned probably. And there's nothing that he can do about it, basically. And she says, "So be it." She accepts her role, right? She says she doesn't regret it. That the inquisitors are murderers, they're monsters, and if we stand by and let them kill innocent people, we're just as bad. So yes, I'm glad it's me and not a whole family that can't protect themselves. So it's really strong words, right? And Tyrus is really moved by them, and he cares about his daughter so much, but also he sees in her all the things that he, you know, wanted, that she's like grown up to be a super moral person, and even more moral than she is, and sees that she's really strong. And as he exits, he thinks about how, you know, if he decides to fight the church, you know, hundreds could die. But he sort of makes the decision that, you know, maybe that's worth it to protect justice, right? To make sure that an innocent person isn't killed, that everyone should defend that. Which makes it, it's really noble. Although I hope he doesn't just, like, order people to fight for him and maybe just makes, like, a rousing speech or something. But, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I really, really dig this story. I mean, overall, like, through and through, it's filled with a nice twist here and a nice twist there, right? And these subtle twists that happen with it, not with her not actually being the one that caused the magic and all that, really does keep me interested in this story throughout. And I mean, that coupled with these nice bits about the wider world, hints at this sort of class slash prejudice system, All of it just really worked well, and I like how nothing in it really felt too forced. Like I there never really for me was a large dump of sort of exposition and setting up how we are slowly moving through this story and this world while it not feeling too forced upon me, making it a pretty easy and smooth read. And I really do like towards the ending how the commentary on truthfulness and nobility really does come into question. And I love a lot of things being said about it. So really great job.
Yeah, this was a really great story. I think it was really well executed with the emotions that you're trying to evoke here and the sense of injustice. I love this journey here. I know there's a lot of setup for other stuff, but it stands really, really well on its own.
Those are all of the stories we will be reading for this week. But we do want to say a good old Do the Right Thing shout out to everyone who did leave a story. So thank you very much to Wook Against the Machine.
Thank you to Ace of Sword.
Thank you, Nick Yu.
Thank you, Glittering Coast.
Thank you, Captain Rhino.
Thank you, Matt Said Words.
Thank you, Calinero985.
And thank you, Moradinamail.
Mm-hmm. And we also want to say thank you to everyone who did leave two or more comments. Leaving two comments not only allows you to say more about your own piece, but you're also providing someone else with crucial feedback to help them become a better writer. So thank you very much to Wook Against the Machine, Matt Said Words, Nick Yu, Captain Rhino, and Glittering Coast. Thank you so much for leaving comments.
Yeah, there was really, really good comments this week. Y'all did a really fantastic job. It was so nice to see a comment followed by someone else, you know, responding to that one. Mm-hmm. or adding to it. That was brilliant. So we really, really appreciate that. You know, there was an uptick, right? I'm sure people are sending in the stories, and right before the due date of the Do the Right Thing contest, trying to get a story in, which is super, super valid. And as the weeks go on, even though this contest has ended, the amount of time where we'll be accepting like the new. For the next contest, we'll be accepting prompts starting with this week, right? So in 3 months, we'll have the next Do the Right Thing contest, and you'll be able to use the story from whatever story you write this week coming now. So even though there's not a contest for a while, you know, don't shy away from writing stories now to, you know, have that stuff to work with when the time rolls around.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. If you want to be like all of these wonderful writers and submit your story to Do the Right Thing, you can do that by going to /r/Do the Right Thing. All you have to do is sit down for 30 minutes and write a complete short story using 3 or 4 words from that week.
That's right. The place to find out the words as soon as possible would be on Twitter, which is @RightThingCast. Don't forget to follow our Doof Media Twitter for other assorted announcements about, you know, patron sort of stuff and or anything else. You know, turn on your notifications, hit that bell, right? Or you don't have to do that, but if you want to hear the stuff as soon as it comes out, that's a good place to do it. Actually, I mean, hitting the bell for Do the Right Thing is not a bad idea, you know, considering we only do an announcement like every week or two, you know, like one or two a week, so it's not like we're gonna spam you. Don't hit the bell for my personal Twitter account. You will get very annoyed.
Mm-hmm. And if you want to support us and everyone else in the Doof Media, you can do that by donating to the Doof Media Patreon. All you have to do is donate $5 or more per month, and you'll get access to the Doof Media Discord, including exclusive bonus content at the $10 level.
That's right. We were just talking off air about what the next Doofover should be after our next two that we're planning to do this month. It's now winter, so I actually have time to binge stuff. So maybe we could get even. We'll get those two out at least. So Death Note and Steins Gate. But after that, you know what I was thinking? If I can set it up, I don't have a PlayStation 2 at hand, but
yeah.
I really want to play the Shadow the Hedgehog game again.
The best game ever made,
it's
baby.
So edgy. It's so edgy, y'all. It's
Chaos Control.
It's Sonic, but with the guns.
Sonic and guns, like, and even more edge.
And he kills all the Sonic characters. I remember there was two fights that were like right after each other, two boss battles, right? One, mm-hmm. the first one was where you kill the bee kid, right? Kill the bee kid. So he's like the cutest, most like innocent kid.
So you were going on the dark path.
And then you fight a tank. Mm-hmm. is the next one. So that was the two, one right after another.
Have you been able to play that level where you kill the president?
No.
Oh.
That sounds great.
It is one of the most fun levels because you don't have to, but it's very hard to do it. But it's worth it.
I'm going to 100% Shadow the Hedgehog, the game, the movie.
So, you know, that means you get to play it 8 times.
You know what they should have? They shouldn't have made Sonic a Sonic movie. They should have made a Shadow the Hedgehog
movie. Yes. Yeah. Rated R.
It's Shadow. And the love interest is, what's her name? The sexy Sonic character? You know the one?
Rouge.
Yeah, Rouge. Yeah, or whatever. Rogue? Mm-hmm. Rouge? I don't know.
I think it's Rouge.
Ragu. Mm-hmm.
Rago.
She's a love interest. And make her, like really sexy. Like, really, ooh. Like...
They, like, have sex 30 minutes in.
Like... Megan Fox and Transformers sexy, where it's like it's technically still PG-13, but like, wow, this is borderline, like,
that's a lot,
like this is exploitative and this is unacceptable. Mm. But it's an animated character, so it's just an insult to women in general and not like a particular woman.
It's fine. Also, I mean, it's a Batwoman, come on.
That makes her even sexier. Yep. Mm-hmm. Anyone who doesn't know who Rouge is, don't Google her right now.
Please, just
don't Google her and be like, oh,
Rule 34.
This is who Alexander was talking about when they were saying that Rouge is sexy. Don't do that to me. If you don't know who she is, keep it that way.
If you know, you know. All right.
No, but you know who's really sexy?
The crocodile guy.
No. Oh, that's, yes. But I was going to say Tails as a total twink.
Tails?
Yeah, total twink. Total.
Sorry, that's not my cup of tea. I'm more of a Knuckles person.
He's got some, like, innocence to him, and it's, like, cute, you know?
That's true. And he's also pretty smart, but I hate talking to him.
Yeah, he's pretty annoying. He's like your... Okay, I'm not going to continue talking about this. I'm sorry,
whoa,
y'all.
If
you're going to cancel for me for anything, do it for saying that Tails is sexy. He's not sexy.
I will cancel you for that. Tails is underage, right?
Well, okay. You know what? Don't fucking say that. Now I feel weird. Shut up. Whatever. fuck you.
Did the PD open up?
God damn it.
Now
we feel
can
weird.
You tell me what is going on in Doof Media?
Plenty of stuff is going on in Doof Media. My cat's pawing at the door. We have to wrap this episode up right now. Rusty's gonna kill me. Okay. We've got plenty of stuff going on. I know that the Doof and Chill should be this week. We're playing Phasmophobia. I actually don't know who's going to be there for that one, but that's going to be a lot of fun. That's a spooky game. I think it's basically where everyone, it's a 4-player game where everyone is basically a ghost hunting team. They have to identify the ghosts and find out what they are and stuff like that. So that seems like a lot of fun, and it should be a little spooky and maybe elicit some screams and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Doof Game Club over Dark Souls was just this past weekend, so that was really, really exciting. Elliot and Ruben talked about Dark Souls for 2 hours, and that was really fun, and we got to see their experiences and stuff like that. I think they had a nuanced take on Dark Souls, pros and cons. So that was pretty cool. And of course, there's so much else going on at Doof Media, so many other podcasts that you can check out. You know, if you have any more time, or if you're caught up with one, consider starting a new one, right? Maybe Kingslingers. Maybe What You Say. Maybe Pale Reflections. Catch up on Pale. Pale is super good. My cat is yelling at me. So there's plenty of stuff going on.
Nice, nice. Real quick, what language does your cat speak?
I don't know a joke for this, so...
Say canine.
Canine?
That's pretty funny.
Okay. Okay, he's tearing apart my carpet. Can we please get out of here?
Yes, we can. So, now it's the best time of the entire podcast, is announcing next week's words.
Well, our stories have been getting too long. I'm going to just say that right now. They've been our stories at the end of the podcast are getting way too long.
That is true.
So, let's get snappy with it. Keeping in mind that real quick, what's the story we'll be reading next week?
The story we will be reading next week is a Modest Proposal by Dr. Jonathan Swift. And we will be reading sections from it. I mean, it's not a too long short story, but it would take a large chunk of time. Yeah, it's a good
3,500 words, which is, and it's not like super flowy either.
Yeah, exactly. Next week we'll be focusing on satire.
Yeah, that's right. I'll probably post a Google Doc with a cut down version of it. Is what I'm going to do. But okay, what are the words for next week?
I'm glad that you asked. The words for next week are tribe, subway, outlook, and entertain.
So a tribe, which is a group of people usually related in some sense. There's also the sense of cultural tribes. Mm-hmm. Now it evokes a sort of, I don't know. It's so annoying because so many of these terms are so like racially charged, you know, like, yes. I don't want to say the word primitive, you know, because that's
but I mean, when you do think of tribes, you think of more primitive, typically maybe African.
Yeah, I guess it just feels weird to talk about it like that. Like,
I mean, it is weird, but that's just like, that's how
that's the language word has that we have used. Available yeah. to us, I guess.
Yeah.
So that's frustrating. But anyway, so it's usually like a larger family group kind of, or not family group, you know what I mean? Like a clan kind of thing.
A tribe,
anyway,
yeah.
Yeah, tribe. The next one is Subway, which is the fast food chain. That's about it. That's the only thing I can think of.
And they make okay sandwiches, but don't get their tuna.
So a couple times I've gone to Subways in the middle of nowhere, and they have this really weird smell that I've only encountered a couple times, and it's like extremely unpleasant, but not in a way you'd think. It's like this like metallic smell that sort of is like in the back of your nose, like back and down,
and so it's like throaty,
but above your mouth is kind of where it is.
And so it's like in that like nose ridge that's in the back of your.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. And it's not like a sharp metal scent, but it sort of is somehow metallic. It's really weird, and it's super hard to explain, and it's super unpleasant, but it's not like, it doesn't smell just like, it doesn't stink, you know what I mean? It's really weird. Yeah. Anyway, if you smell that smell, it's terrible, so get out of there. Anyway.
Yeah.
Also, their subway systems, obviously, I was joking about only being one thing. Anyway. The next one, the Outlook, the email service. That's all.
Yeah. Or maybe a positive outlook on life.
Yeah. There's the positive outlook on life. And then entertain, which is to amuse someone else with your antics. So Jarvis, tell me a story with these words right now.
So a story that I'm going to be talking about next week is basically the Warriors fan fiction. So we follow this nice tribe of these kind of street hockey punks, right?
Street and the writing hockey punk cats.
Yeah, and the riding the subway to go and fight the like a clown gang. But you see, one of them is kind of fed up with this life that they've been living. I mean, it is fun. And he loves hanging out with the bros, but he wants more from his life. He wants to be a stand-up comedian. He wants to be a entertainer. He doesn't want to keep on beating up other kids just for this fake sort of territory. So he decides to change his outlook on life and drop everything that he knows to start a 9-to-5 job.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's something we can all aspire to.
A 9-to-5 job, yeah.
Getting a job. So my story is about this this tribe of musicians that lived in the sewers and subways of New York City. So they were actually all rats, and they would play human-sized instruments. It was actually like a really complicated sort of setup that they had, involving like hitting themselves against the drums and you know, doing coordinated jumping off of little diving boards to get on the drum and make the proper beat. It was kind of pretty incredible, and they entertained lots of people down there in the subway. But then they were approached by a manager who said that they could make them huge, right? Make them gigantic. And they all went as, you know, as a band, right? And they started touring, and they, you know, got really famous. But as they went, their sort of outlook on the whole thing changed, and they realized that they'd just been exploited by this terrible manager, and that they, you know, didn't want to be fake anymore. And then they returned to the subways, where they were killed by a pesticide company.
Damn. So they got Motowned.
Yep.
Mm. You know what? I mean, I know if you're coming up and you want to make some like good music, it is good to sign with a record company. But sometimes you have to really stop and think, is this doing the right thing? Is selling a portion of myself to this company good for the music? You should have sex with Knuckles.
That's right.
I want to get packing.
I want to get fisted by Knuckles.
Oh my god, that would actually kill you.